Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah, good evening. Sally Steele. The show's not streaming right now for some reason. Hopefully it will shortly. Not quite exactly sure why we're not streaming here. I'll have to go to the request support. Unfortunately, this happens once in a while, and for those of you who are trying, of course, you're not going to be able to hear the program. It's not streaming.
Syncretism
in the individual character of the Savior Jesus Christ and is in concrete historical basis for the Old Testament. Therefore, Christianity could be assimilated by elements of the religious philosophical syncretism of the later ancient world without losing its historical foundation. But it could not assimilate the genuine Stoic attitude. This is especially remarkable when we consider the tremendous influence of the Stoic doctrines of the logos of the natural moral law on both Christian dogmatics and ethics. But this large reception of Stoic ideas could not bridge the gap between the acceptance of cosmic resignation in Stoicism and the faith in cosmic salvation in Christianity. The victory of the Christian Church pushed Stoicism into an obscurity from which it emerged only in the beginning of the modern period. Neither was the Roman Empire an alternative to Christianity. I'm getting into this. I'm going to skip over this because I hate to deal. I mean, Tillich was obviously he was a Christian apologist and theologian, but. Let me go into Spinoza and the concept of the will. Stoicism retired into the background with faith in cosmic salvation, replaced the courage of cosmic renunciation. But it returned when the medieval system, which was dominated by the problem of salvation, began to disintegrate. And it became decisive again for an intellectual elite, which rejected the way of salvation without, however, replacing it with the Stoic way of renunciation. Because of the impact of Christianity on the Western world, the revival of the ancient schools of thought at the beginning of the modern period was not only a revival, but also a transformation. This is true of the revival of Platonism, as well as that of skepticism and Stoicism. It is true of the renewal of the arts of literature and the theories of the state and the philosophy of religion. In all these cases, the negativity of the late ancient feeling toward life is transformed into the positiveness of the Christian ideas of creation and incarnation, even if these ideas are either ignored or denied. And the spiritual substance of Renaissance humanism was Christian as the spiritual substance of ancient humanism was pagan. In spite of the Christian criticism of the pagan religions by Greek humanism and of Christianity by modern humanism, The decisive difference between both types of humanism is the answer to this question whether being is essentially good or not. While the symbol of creation implies the classical Christian doctrine that being is good, the doctrine of the resisting matter in Greek philosophy expresses the pagan feeling that being is necessarily ambiguous, insofar as it participates in both creative form and inhibiting matter. This contrast in the basic ontological conception has decisive consequences. While in later antiquity, the various forms of metaphysical and religious dualism are tied up with the aesthetic ideal, negation of matter, the rebirth of antiquity in the modern period replaced aestheticism by active shaping of the material realm. And while in the ancient world the tragic feeling toward existence dominated thought and life, especially the attitude toward history, the Renaissance started a movement which was looking at the future and created and new in it. And the creative and new in it. Hope conquered the feeling of tragedy and belief in progress and resignation to circular repetition. A third consequence of basic ontological difference is the contrast in the evaluation of the individual on the part of the ancient and modern humanism. While the ancient world valued the individual not as an individual, but as a representative of something universal, a virtue, the rebirth of antiquity saw in the individual, as an individual, a unique expression of the universe, incomparable, irreplaceable, and of infinite significance. It is obvious that these differences created decisive differences in the interpretation of courage. It is not the contrast between renunciation and salvation to which I am referring now. Modern humanism is still humanism, rejecting the idea of salvation. But modern humanism also rejects renunciation. It replaces it by a kind of self-affirmation and transcends that of the Stoics because it includes the material, historical, and individual existence. Nevertheless, there are so many points in which this modern humanism is identical with which Stoicism that it may be called neo-Stoicism. Spinoza in I'm not really sure what's going on here. I'm trying to request support. The crap. Our show is still not, it's going to take me a little time to figure this thing out. But I don't know. Well, it appears that they've cut me off here for some reason, and I really don't know why. So bear with me, and you'll have to listen to this in the archives. This book I should have recognized as I'm reading it again. Has a tremendous number of it deals with such a level of it deals on such a metaphysical level of courage, and but it also it also presents the historical perspective of courage and why, how it develops over time and how people became more or less courageous, if you will, as the definition of courage changed, you know, with society, with religions and faith and fate and destiny and legends and, you know, mythology and so on. A great and courageous person, individual, is to me, and from what I can understand, is from all that I've read or experienced on the subject, is a person who has the courage to stand up for his convictions or her convictions, the courage to face adversity, and be unflappable, really, in their commitment to their cause, to their purpose, to their strength of being. And in that regard, we lose our, so many people have lost their way, have lost their courage, have lost their battles, because they basically are lost. They've lost the center of their themselves. They lost their souls in confusion and in frustration and in poverty and in abuse, it's not to say that everyone has lost their way. I brought up last week the example of the courage of the people in Haiti facing that horrible horrible disaster. Some people, after 2 weeks, have just been pulled out of the rubble. Now, that is courage. That is faith. That is a miracle, you know. And those are all aspects of what courage is. Those are the will to live, the will to succeed, the will to overcome obstacles, the will to learn, and the will to accept criticism, accept change, accept all the things that we must accept in order to live, all the adversities. And that courage is essentially that. It's a given gift, and some have it and some people do not. Some people are absolutely cowardly, and why that is, I don't know. Maybe because they've had the spirit beaten out of them. I don't know. Or they weren't born with it. I it's hard to explain. But why some people will be is a prime example. Today I received an email from a good friend who's a Palestinian activist, and she was absolutely horrified. She lives in Connecticut here with me, in our in the area, and she was absolutely disgusted and horrified at the idea that all that a letter to Obama. Based on the withdraw his support of the Israeli sanctions against Palestine, was not signed by any member of the Connecticut Assembly, and that's absolutely horrifying. That these people are representatives of elected representatives of this country, of this state, and of the collective body, if you will, of law makers in this state, and they don't have the moral courage to go up against AIPAC, to go against the horrors being inflicted against these poor Palestinian people by the Zionist regime of genociders. I mean, these people are trying to ethnically cleanse the entire area. And we, as a country, we as a state of Connecticut, the Constitution state, we like to call ourselves, aren't even able to... can't even sign this simple letter to President Obama to back off. And I think that tells a lot about the cowardice, the absolute cowardice and lack of moral leadership that we face here in this state, the state of Connecticut, but also this country. Okay, and it's a frightening thing to experience that kind of cowardice in our leadership. And it's a frightening thing to see it in anybody. But, well, we all have our moments. We all have our moments of weakness. But at the same time, we hope that when all is told, all is tallied, that we've had far more moments of courage in our lives than of weakness. And I think that's what makes the difference in their lives, what makes a person viable as a human being, okay? And not as a an animal. Is that, even animals have greater courage than many human beings. I mean, that courage is in their strength and their cunning and their ability to survive. But there are so many cowards, so many horrible cowards and criminals in this world that we lose sight of those very courageous ones. And when there is somebody who stands up and fights for injustice, then, you know, that's a brave man. You have Martin Luther King's, you have Mahatma Gandhi's, Abraham Lincoln's, George Washington's, Thomas Jefferson's. I mean, people that tried to do something, create something. And now we're at a point where we just have nothing. And that's why our country is falling apart. And for that purpose, who knows what we have. I think someone. I forget who said it best, but if you look at the, when we talked about this a number of times in our show, especially on this particular show, where man's journey, if you will, his evolution, his journey to his enlightenment, is actually a journey toward his Christhood, toward Christhood. That's what we all wish to be. That's all we wish to become, is the best that we can possibly be, and not the worst that we can be. And the worst that we can be is George W. Bush, Rothschilds, the demons and the devil worshippers and the sociopaths. And there are those. Well, I don't know if there's any redeeming quality in people like this, but maybe there is. But on as a liberal, we're supposed to believe in the good of mankind. And I believe the collective good of mankind is there, and I believe that we have collective the courage, and there are so many of us, so many people out there that have tremendous courage, that will fight. I mean, soldiers and civilians alike will fight the battles every day and fight the wars and fight foreclosures and all the stresses and the strains and the diseases and everything that come against us. We continue to fight. And that, my friends, is courage. That's courage. That's strength and will and courage. In the ancient days, before Christianity, people believed in reincarnation. They believed in greatness. They believed in the human qualities of whatever it was. That man could be great, and people strove to be, even though they existed within a medium of mediocrity, in a lot of ways, we all do that, but they strove in their own ways to their own valiant ways. When their villages were being marauded, they stood up and fought against the marauders, and with their lives and with pitchforks and whatever they had, whatever weapons they had available to them. And you had great leaders come out of that, those times, the medieval times, the ancient times, and spokesmen and heroes, great heroes, who arose to vindicate the people and protect the people. And those men are heralded today in legends. Bibles, epic poets, epic poetry. They're the Achilles and Hectors and Socrates and Plato's and so on, who, and Christ's, if you will, all men who strove for perfection in their own lives and strove for moral purpose and fortitude and a faith in themselves, a faith in their gods, and faith in their system of in their own strength, their own ability to ride through the worst of times, knowing that somehow there's a cosmic retribution for those who do not. And if you don't fight, then you have nothing but death and enslavement. And I personally can't think of anything worse than to be enslaved, to be abused in that fashion, or to allow myself to be enslaved, to allow myself to cower to the government's wrongs, to evil men, to people who want to harm you and steal from you, I can't. It's not in my nature to do that. But at the same time, we must have understanding. Yeah, so we can't be chopping off everybody's heads. I mean, we have to think for a minute and have some compassion and some understanding of what these people or powers, if you will, are, and why they exist and why we allow them to exist as a society. And it's because most people are frightened. Most people are afraid. Back 100 years ago or 150 years ago, people wore weapons outside of their, on their gun belts and swords and knives and daggers, because they knew they may have to defend themselves in some way or some place. Whereas the other people, whereas today, you can't go around with a gun outside of your. You can have a concealed, weapon. You can have that. You can do that stuff. But I'm gonna send another note here to these jokers. Streaming. Submit it and sending message. So message sent. So if the message is sent, folks, here we are. Right? Damn. I don't know what it's going to take to get us back here. Oh boy. So anyway. It's so awkward not being able to, like anybody's hearing me here, but I'm going to continue. Types of anxiety. This is from the book again. Being, non-being, and anxiety. Types of anxiety. Three types of anxiety and the nature of man. Non-being is dependent on the being it negates. Again, let me state that again. Non-being is dependent on the being it negates. Dependent means two things. It points, first of all, to the metaphysical priority of being over non-being. Of being over non-being. Okay. The term non-being itself indicates this, and it is logically necessary. There could be no negation if there were no preceding affirmation to be negated. Certainly one can decide being in terms of non-being, and one can justify such a description by pointing to the astonishing pre-rational fact that there is something and not nothing. One could say that being is the negation of the primordial night of nothingness. But in doing so, one must realize that such an aboriginal nothing to be neither nothing nor something, that it becomes nothing only in contrast to something. In other words, that the ontological status of non-being is dependent on being. I don't know if this guy's making any sense to you, but it's a little bizarre. Sounds like Rumsfeld. And secondly, non-being is dependent on the special qualities of being. In itself, non-being has no quality and no difference of qualities, but it gets them in relation to being. And the character of the negation of being is determined by that in being which is negated. This makes it possible to speak of qualities of non-being and consequently of types of anxiety. So in other words, because we exist, we can talk about non-existence. If we didn't exist, then we would have no ability to talk about it. So up to now, we have used the term non-being without differentiation, while in the discussion of courage, several forms of self-affirmation are mentioned. They correspond to different forms of anxiety and are understanding only in correlation with them. I suggest that we distinguish three types of anxiety according to the three directions in which non-being threatens being. Non-being threatens man's ontic self-affirmation. Relatively in terms of fate, absolutely in terms of death. It threatens man's spiritual self-affirmation, relatively in terms of emptiness, absolutely in terms of meaninglessness. It threatens man's moral self-affirmation, relatively in terms of guilt, absolutely in terms of condemnation. The awareness of this threefold threat is anxiety appearing in three forms, that of fate and death. Briefly, the anxiety of death, that emptiness and loss of being, of meaning, really. And briefly, an anxiety of meaninglessness, that of guilt and condemnation. Briefly, the anxiety of condemnation. In all three forms, anxiety is existential in the sense that it belongs to existence as such and not to an abnormal state of mind as in neurotic and psychotic anxiety. The nature of neurotic anxiety and its relation to existential anxiety will be discussed in another chapter. We shall deal now with the three forms of existential anxiety, first with their reality in the life of the individual, then with their social manifestations and special periods of Western history. However, it must be stated that the difference of types does not mean mutual exclusion. In the first chapter, we have seen, for instance, that the courage to be, as it appears in the ancient Stoics, conquers not only the fear of death, but also the threat of meaninglessness. In Nietzsche, we find that in spite of the predominance of the threat of meaninglessness, the anxiety of death and condemnation is passionately challenged. In all representatives of classical Christianity, death and sin are seen as the allied adversaries against which the courage of faith has to fight. The three forms of anxiety and of courage are imminent in each other, but nominally under the dominance of one of them. I'm still not streaming here, so bear with me if you're listening to this in the archives. I'm projecting the future here, that somebody will be listening to this in the future. The anxiety of fate and death. Fate and death are the way in which our ontic self-affirmation is threatening by non-being. ontic, from the Greek on, being, means there is, meaning here the basic self-affirmation of a being in its simple existence. Ontological designates the philosophical analysis of the nature of being. And the anxiety of fate and death is most basic, most universal and escapable, and inescapable. All attempts to argue it away are futile. Even if the so-called arguments from the immortality of the soul, an augmented power, which they do not have, they would not convince existentially. For existentially, everybody is aware of the complete loss of self, which biological extinction implies. The unsophisticated mind knows instinctively that sophisticated ontology formulates that reality has the basic structure of self-world correlation, and that with the disappearance of the one side, the world, the other side, the self, also disappears. And what remains is their common ground, but not their structural correlation. It has been observed that the anxiety of death increases with the increase of individualization, and that people in collectivistic cultures are less open to this type of anxiety. The observation is correct, yet explanation that there is no basic anxiety about death in collectivist cultures is wrong. The reason for the difference from more individualized civilizations is that the special type of courage which characterizes collectivism, as long as it is unshaken, allays the anxiety of death. But the very fact that courage has to be created through many internal and external psychological and ritual activities and symbols shows that basic anxiety has to be overcome even in collectivism. Without its at least potential presence, neither war nor the criminal law in these societies would be understandable. If there were no fear of death, the threat of the law or of a superior enemy would be without effect, which it obviously is not. Man as man is in every civilization is anxiously aware of the threat of non-being and needs the courage to affirm himself in spite of it. Every man faces the thought of death, and you know, when you face that thought, you face it with fear, then it'll overwhelm you and diminish your courage and create cowardice. If you fear criticism, then you'll say nothing that you could possibly be criticized for, and at that point be virtually a non-being, you know, a person without any, without anything to say, for fear that they might be criticized or that they might offend. The fear of poverty, man has a great fear of poverty, it always does, we all do. But what happens is, and this goes back a ways, and I don't know if anybody's ever heard of Napoleon Hill and his laws of success and Think and Grow Rich, his great books on self-motivation and so on. He claims that there are cosmic laws, and there are. There's no question about that. There are. But the cosmic laws essentially validate your existence and guide you along. The greatest cosmic law is probably cause and effect. Whatever you do, your actions create effects, and effects create results. Whatever those are, whether good, bad, or indifferent. But if you're courageous in your conviction, if you're, and I hate to say this, but if you're blindly if you're focused, fully focused, stay resolved in achieving something, then you will achieve that, regardless of the victory, regardless. But if you invoke the rituals, and we all do that, we all invoke ritual, and whenever we're up against combat, it may be subtle, it may be obvious, but it may be a secret ritual before battle, or the ritual before, like a matador, before he goes out to fight the bull, he goes into deep prayer, that he's given the courage to fight the bull and that he's given the courage to conquer his fear. And it's the same with anybody. You know, bull riders, keep their lucky coins or give the sign of the cross. I don't know how many people have seen baseball players or fighters or, so many athletes have rituals that they go through before they're tested. And we do the same thing, but when people don't realize that what that does is it instills focus and instills strength and singularness of purpose. And it allows us to overcome whatever that obstacle is, regardless of how difficult it may be and how overwhelming. Like, yeah, the stories of David and Goliath, you have these stories, Odysseus and his Odyssey. We have these wonderful stories, legends of great people, great men and women that have overcome tremendous adversity and in their lives and have come out right because they've been tested by the gods, if you will. It was a remarkable poem, and I was thinking of it. I was hoping to find it tonight, but I couldn't locate it. It was called When God Makes a Man. And it was a wonderful poem, and it was in the works of great works by Napoleon Hill in his Laws of Success. Actually, that was the only place I've ever seen that poem written, and it was essentially this, that when God makes a man, he breaks the man. When God makes a man, he hardens him. Throws everything at him, throws everything he can at him to see what he's made of, to see if he's tried and true, to see if he's faithful, continues to be faithful. And this is the story of Job, the courage of Job and the faith of Job. This is the courage of Christ. This is the courage of all great men who've mounted philosophies, these prophets and martyrs and people that have just phenomenal faith in what they were doing. And it's as though they weren't concerned even with this life. I think of Martin Luther King Jr., who knew, could see his death, but yet he forged on. He saw it. He gave that great speech the night before he died. I may not get there with you, but you're going to see the promised land. And it was the same with Moses. Moses said, he was not allowed to see. You could see it from a mountaintop, but he was not allowed to venture into the promised land. And he was turned away. God told him he couldn't because he fought against him and questioned his authority. And in doing that, and in questioning our faith, we either strengthen it or weaken it. Personally, I've done both. And I now have a faith that's much stronger than ever before. Faith in myself, faith in God, universe, that it's that there is a plan, there is a purpose, there is a reason that we exist, and it's up to us here in this life to, and I say this life because we may have had many lives. I personally have had a past life regression and have identified perhaps a dozen lives. And I probably could have found more. I just was overwhelmed at that through self-hypnosis. But you identify this. But in each individual lifetime, the one thing that I noticed that I was able to discern from those glimpses of my past existences was a determination, a strange determination in each individual, regardless of what it was. One was a pirate. One was a pirate. One was a Roman senator. Another was a musician, an Indian musician, who had women pickpocket. His wife and daughter were pickpockets, and they were dance and pick the pockets of the people who would watch them. There were other lives that were in my regressions that have identified very fascinating, interesting people. And there was another in my life where I was a Knight Templar who was tortured and blinded and cast out, left alive to wander as a beggar. And all of these lives have taught me something that I realized after I had this past regression, that there was some, that on none of those lives was I at all afraid. Each life seemed that I faced adversity in the toughest ways as a warrior, as a politician, as a as a Knight Templar, as a out of the 12, and I won't go into all of them, and there were more probably, but I guess what I'm driving at is that in each one I identified that courage, that thread of courage that allowed me to face death. Each time I faced death in one way, and I saw that death in that regression. But yet, not one time did I doubt or fear death. In fact, I challenged it. I guess I still do. I test fate. It's kind of stupid to do that, but it's part of my nature, and I can't help myself. But it's like doing whatever you can to do, and to understand that you're creating courage as I know it, as I understand it. And I'm not, I falter like everyone. But courage is essentially the ability, the inner strength, that soul that you have that understands that regardless of what you do, what you do has its cause and its effects. What you do, whatever you do, like right now I'm talking to empty space because the show's not streaming. But I understand this, that it will, okay? That it will go on. And even if it doesn't go on, well, I've spent an hour talking to myself. But at the same time, I've learned something more. I've read something of this book, even though I've read it out loud. I've read of the anxieties. I've read of the challenges. I've read of, I've described courage in its metaphysical sense. And courage comes out of, in its, courage comes out in the physical as well. It's a nobility of spirit that can't be underestimated. When one is dealing with the spirit, whatever your spirit is will manifest into the physical. So in other words, if you're mean and if you're confused and if you're broken, it will appear in your physical appearance. It'll take over your body because the spirit and the body are one. And the spirit, the body is merely a reflection of your spirit. If your spirit is dull, if your spirit is broken, if your spirit is lazy, if your spirit is non-motivated, then your body becomes that way as well. You take on that look. And that's why people of great success, self-confidence, self-worth, and great faith understand that it's important for them to look as well as they can. But it happens without too much effort because as long as they have that sense of self that regardless of how they look, they still carry themselves well, even if their face is torn off or they're, disastrously burned or whatever, there's a spirit within them and a courage within them and there's a miracle within them happening that will come forward. And there will be a charisma and there will be an energy and there will be an enthusiasm and there will be a kindness and a love in their spirit that will create the ambiance, if you will, or create the camaraderie, create the friendships, create the genuine good feelings people have around you. If you're a wicked person, if you let the world go down, if you've destroyed yourself in some way and can't come back up, then you see that as well and you become a homeless and not just homeless but decrepit and drunk on the street and sleeping in the alleys or sleeping on the sidewalk in front of people and people walking over you or around you, looking at this hulk of a body, this flesh just worthless. And so it's important, regardless of where you are, regardless of your station in life, regardless of your adversity in life, to always have that faith that you're here for a reason and that purpose, and whatever that purpose may be, whether it's to suffer through life because of a past life, something in your past life that you did, and you have a chance to re-learn or redo or whatever it may be. But I believe we're always learning. I believe we're always creating something. Regardless of what it is and regardless of how we do it, it's always leading us to, let's face it, even the most mean-spirited individual unbelievably courageous in the sense that they'll attack and they'll fight to the end, right? Out of hatred, or out of meanness, or out of whatever it is. But they know they can conquer it because they know they can do it. And then that in itself is courage. However, the true courage, the truest of all courage, and the highest and best is when one can face all adversity and still remain kind, still remain curious, still retain their integrity, and whatever. And that's the best they can do. And I pity anybody who has debilitating diseases that do that. But I wanted to note on everybody should have a living will. I do. And so that you can not only live with dignity, you can die with dignity. You can not only live with courage, you can die courageously. And saying goodbye to life and accepting your future beyond life into the infinite. And essentially that's where we'll leave. I apologize to those who may have tried to listen to the show tonight. I guess my helpline is not helping. The show did not stream live. But I hope you'll be able to catch it on the archives. We won't be having George on tomorrow night. That's he's on next week. We'll be off. So please tell your friends. Please join us next Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. And I hope you have a good evening. So remember, if you take anything away from tonight, that courage, individual courage, faith, purpose, commitment, cause, actions, causes, effects, and lead to results. And you always want the best possible results. So your actions must proceed to create the effects that you wish for, and of course the results. So with that thought, I'll end tonight. I have about 40 seconds left to the show, and I wish everybody well, wish everybody a good weekend, and